From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we say happy 100th birthday to the nation's park system.
In the coming years and decades, we have to have the foresight and the faith in our future to do what it takes to protect our parks and protect our planet for generations to come.
Also today, Salem officials suggest that an explosion in the news box of an LGBTQ newspaper was a hate crime. And after the hacking of actress Leslie Jones' website, we ask, who is policing the internet?
What scared me was the injustice of a gang of people jumping against you for such a sick cause.
All this plus a trip to the drive-in.
So we have pillows and sleeping bags and
I only bought a blanket.
Blankets, pajamas. We take our drive-in experience seriously.
Every time I have a date, there's only one place to go. That's to the drive-in.
Coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, we want to start today by saying happy birthday to the National Park Service. It is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the system created by President Wilson in 1916. President Obama marked the occasion earlier this week with the creation of a new national park in Maine's North Woods. When we talk about national parks, sometimes it's the big ones that come to mind, Yellowstone or Yosemite or maybe the Grand Canyon. But today is a good day to point out the national parks right here in Massachusetts and New England. Here's Congressman Michael Capuano speaking at a National Park System celebration on Boston's waterfront today.
I, for one, I never knew we had islands in Boston Harbor. And I'm not kidding. I didn't know it. I think I was in my 30s before I went to any place that I thought was a national park. That's why I personally think it's so critically important to have national parks in urban areas.
And some of our national parks are in urban areas, including the Harbor Islands, the Lowell National Historic Park, and the Boston African American National Historic Site, among others. That's on top of almost 30 state parks and thousands of other conservation areas throughout the region. So today we're going to talk about parks, especially national parks. Joining us in studio is Jack Clark. He's Mass Audubon's Director of Public Policy and a former park ranger at the Cape Cod National Seashore. Jack, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Also on the line with us from Lowell is Celeste Bernardo. She's superintendent at Lowell National Historical Park and a 30-year veteran of the Park Service. Celeste, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And listeners, we want to invite you to join this conversation. How are you celebrating the National Park Centennial today? Are the parks important to you? And what are some of your favorite New England parks to visit? What do you think we should do to further protect these national treasures? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, or send us a tweet at Radio Boston, maybe a photo of what you're doing today. There are hikes taking place around the state today to mark this centennial. But Jack, I want to start with you. Let's talk just briefly first about the history of the park system, because in 1916 also Mass Audubon opened its first wildlife sanctuary. So there were things happening simultaneously there.
Thank you, Deborah. We did. And Mass Audubon today is among the oldest and largest conservation organizations in the country. And our founding mothers, Minna Hall and Harriet Hemingway, were close to Teddy Roosevelt, who also thought the National Park Service was a good idea. And then 100 years ago, we established our first wildlife sanctuary at Moose Hill in Sharon, Massachusetts. Mm. It's now one of our over 100 sanctuaries we have, encompassing 35,000 acres of land from the Cape and Islands out to the Berkshires.
Mm. I'm just wondering, when you talk about conservation, and then you talk about parks and recreation, right? There must be some efforts that have to be made to balance those two things, right?
There is, especially with the National Park Service. For instance, the Cape Cod National Seashore, where I worked for 10 seasons, the last time I was wearing that Ranger Stetson hat, loved to death. 4 million visitors a year, a very fragile ecosystem with a series of barrier beaches and salt marshes and that sort of thing. So it was a matter of loving, appreciating, understanding the natural beauty of that whole area, and at the same time protecting it from overuse and overappreciation.
Right. I think it's the 14th, right? Most popular park in the country out of all the national parks is the National Seashore.
It is. You know, 25% of the nation's driving population is within a 24-hour distance of the Cape Cod National Seashore. And sometimes we think they all come.
Well, Celeste, tell us about the Lowell National Historic Park. How are you celebrating the centennial today?
Well, we have a lot of activities planned. Today we had a flag raising. We were fortunate to have Congresswoman Tsongas, who is a huge supporter of the parks, with us today. So we were thrilled by that. A lot of big community celebration. We're a partnership park in Lowell. We celebrate the legacy of industrialization, and we are also very much about the worker, and we do a great deal with the community here. There virtually isn't anything I think we do in Lowell without a partner, in either nonprofits, the city, the state governments, developers. We work with all different types of folks here in the city.
Well, I do want to talk about that in just a minute, about this increasing private support for parks and you know, the good and bad that can come out of that. But I want to talk a little bit about Lowell because it's an urban park and it's a little bit different when we talk about the Boston Harbor Islands as an urban park. I think Lowell has a different feel to it. And I'm just curious as to whether you can compare it to what Jack just told us about the National Seashore being loved to death. Is that happening in Lowell as well?
Well, it depends on what types of programs that we're talking about. When we have an education center that we serve over 50,000 teachers and students, and there are certain times of the year when we're at capacity. We have boat tours that we run on the 5.6 miles of canals. There are certain times when we're at capacity with those, but overall, when you look at spring and fall, we'd like to have more visitors coming, or in the winter, if we can get them out in the New England winters to come. So I think you see that with there are parks that are really overrun at certain times of the year, and other points of the year, visitation drops off a little, and we'd like to try to attract more folks during those times.
I'm wondering, you've been with the Park Service for, what, 30 years throughout New England? Do you think that New England's parks are unique? How are they different from parks in other parts of the country, do you think?
I'm not sure that they're unique. I think that we've had a lot of partnership parks more recently that are being established. Lowell was a partnership park. Boston National Historical Park is a partnership park in that the park is comprised of resources that are not all federally owned. New Bedford Whaling National Historical Park is another one of those models. So the Park Service is here. We own some facilities, but a lot of the historic sites are owned by private partners or other organizations or agencies. We also have in New England a lot of what they call national heritage areas, and those too are the Park Service works in technical support, but a lot of it is community-based and nonprofit organizations that it's sort of interpreting a landscape of significance because of its culture or its heritage. Mm. So I think New England has done a great job in terms of a lot of support. People love parks. They're proud of their history and their heritage and their natural areas, and they want to preserve those. And so they've asked the Park Service, Mass Audubon, state parks to actually come to their communities. That's what happened in Lowell. It was the people of Lowell who called for a national park because they recognized that their history was important here.
You know, we mentioned this event earlier today with Congressman Capuano, and I want to bring a little bit more of what he said today into our conversation. He was at the centennial celebration at Christopher Columbus Park in Boston today, and he talked about some of the challenges for the park system, and of course he said a big problem is funding. Let's listen.
It's easy to add locations to the list of parks, but if you add location and location and location and you don't add money to preserve, money to improve, money to hire more people to do that work, what have you accomplished? In some ways, you've actually diminished the rest of the system.
That's Congressman Capuano speaking today. Jack Clark, I want to ask you about that because we've heard a lot about particularly deferred maintenance costs and what a problem that is for the park system. Is funding a huge issue and why?
Funding is a huge issue. Right now, we probably provide $3 billion a year for our national parks, and it's not enough. The maintenance backlog alone is $10 to $13 billion. And I've read a study this morning from a former cabinet secretary and that said the Park Service probably needs $92 billion a year to keep even, to take care of what they've their backlog and to maintain the properties they have. You mentioned earlier in the segment that President Obama yesterday designated the Katahdin Woods
in
Katahdin Woods and Waters as a new national monument, which will be under the jurisdiction of the National Park Service, and it's adding 87,500 acres to the park system. However, Roxana Quimby, former owner of
Burt's Bees,
right, who donated the land, also donated $20 million to steward it and promised another $20 million. But we expand our parks at great peril when we don't provide the money to take care of them.
And is that the way we're headed? Is that the only way we can fund these new things, is if we have a very wealthy benefactor like the Quimbys be able to donate this land to the government? And that came at great controversy, too.
It did. The Congress was not interested in establishing a national park with a budget. So the president is able, under the Antiquities Act of 1906, to designate the national monument without congressional authority. That's how that happened. Mm-hmm. But let me use as an example the 2011 earthquake in southwest of Washington, D.C., that resulted in extensive damage to the Washington Monument. It was a $15 million price tag to fix that, and Congress provided the National Park Service with $7 million and told them to go find the rest. Fortunately, David Rubenstein, a billionaire philanthropist, provided the rest of the money,
right.
But that's not the way it should be.
Yeah, right. I want to get some listeners in the conversation here because our phone lines are lighting up here. We're asking you, what are you doing to celebrate the National Park Centennial today? Do you have a favorite New England park to visit? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Kathleen is calling from Stowe. Kathleen, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just, we have been to National Seashore and to Lowell and actually did a 5-week cross-country trip where my kids became junior rangers in 10 different national parks.
Wow.
And I have to say, Minuteman is another fantastic park, but we used Lowell as part of a homeschooling with one of my sons, and I was probably up there for 2 months. The two of us were up there 2 or 3 times a week, and the websites are phenomenal. The educational supports are phenomenal. The Tenet Museum in New York, like when you're talking about like late 1800s, it's just so amazing to be able to use the national parks that way. And I think people underestimate just how incredible they are.
All right. Well, there you go. There. Thank you very much for calling, Kathleen. Celeste, that's a little hats off to you there, trumpeting everything in Lowell. What do you think, though, about what we were talking about earlier in terms of this lack of funding and what needs to be done to try to make sure that the parks have enough money?
Well, it's always a difficult one when you talk about money for national parks. I think, you know, to bring a little perspective, when you look at land agencies within the government, the National Park Service has actually done better than a lot of land agencies. The dilemma, as already mentioned, is that the increase in costs, and I don't want to say too much critically about adding parks, because I think it's important that we continue to recognize, as the country changes and the value of what we're preserving historically, there are many sites now that would not have been designated as sites 25 or 30 years ago, or I should say longer, I should say 50 years ago, right? Early parks were really focused on, not focused as much on talking about women's history, social history, the LGBT community. We're bringing in parks now that are really reflective of the diversity of our country. And so that's the dilemma in terms of the idea of not bringing on parks because of funding. It is a challenge.
Right,
it is a challenge.
Right. I'm told that George Price, the superintendent of the Cape Cod National Seashore, is on the line with us. And I want to say hello to you, Mr. Price, and thanks very much for joining in the conversation.
Hello to you, and happy birthday to everybody.
especially
to my friend Celeste. Celeste knows I worked up in Lowell for about 15 years, and now I've been down here at Cape Cod for over 11 and a half. And Celeste's absolutely right. At the time when Lowell was established, actually, there was a lot of controversy because I don't think people could really understand the concept of the Industrial Revolution and what was that all about. And down here at Cape Cod in 1961, this was not a slam dunk park either, because this was very controversial because it involved procuring private land and making a federal park out of it.
Mm. Right. And even, that... Go ahead. I'm sorry, George.
Well, I was going to say it was very controversial. Tip O'Neill was hung in effigy in front of the East Ham Town Hall, and Kurt Vonnegut wrote an article about, was this a communist conspiracy? Mm. So I think the concept of parks has evolved over time, and in 61, Cape Cod was a very early partnership park, and that we have 44,000 acres in our boundary, but we only own 27,000 of those acres in fee ownership by the United States.
Well, you know, we've been talking, I just want to make sure we have time for some callers here, George. We've been talking about money and about how difficult money has been. And, you know, I've read that certainly this was a big political effort on the part of the New England delegation, the Massachusetts delegation, to get the National Seashore established. I'm wondering, have things dramatically changed without Ted Kennedy and John Kerry? And do you feel that you have to do something different to try to get enough support and money, if you will, for the National Seashore?
Well, I think, don't forget, those people were in office during the time when Congress was different and earmarks were different and everything else was different. And I think we certainly recognize the support we get from the congressional delegation, from our senators and our congressmen. So I think times have really changed. The complexion of Congress has changed. And I think just we as a country have to decide where our priorities are. One of the things that Celeste talked about, she's correct, the Park Service has done better with land management agencies, but when you take a look at the federal pie where your income tax go, there's only 5 to 7% of the president's budget that's discretionary, and the Park Service doesn't even show up as a sliver in that pie because we're such a small agency compared to the rest. So I think it's very difficult for our folks on the Hill in order to advocate for us, and we all have to figure out where is it that we want to go as a nation in the future, especially as we have the opportunity to take a look at parks during the centennial year.
All right, Jack, you wanted to add something here.
Yes, and always nice to hear from George Price. George and I wore Ranger hats together years ago. But the additional cost we have is the cost of climate change. And we see that at the Cape Cod National Seashore, which is a seashore experiencing erosion and sea level rise.
I'm wondering, George, can you talk about that just a little bit? What are you seeing because of climate change?
Well, you're absolutely right. You know, just in our lifetime, we've had a sea level rise of about a foot. Huh. And for those that are still, you know, wondering if climate change is real, you just have to come down to the seashore and see some of the changes that we're experiencing. And that has direct impact on shoreline facilities. Obviously, it has an impact on the six towns that are down here because it also affects the towns in the neighborhoods. And we, as a collective group out in the Outer Cape, have to decide what our future is going to be over the next 50-100 years. Mm.
George, is that the biggest challenge facing the National Seashore right now, would you say?
It's certainly right up there. Mm. We have challenges in an urban area that are fundamentally different than a big natural area because we have both the natural and the cultural issues to deal with. Mm-hmm. And when I make a list of our challenges, they pretty much match the same challenges of the six towns. And that has to do with the demographic changes, the cost of living for folks, the changing demographics of our visitation. We're still, the goal of the centennial is to outreach to certainly younger people and more diverse background folks so they can take a look at what parks have to offer, both for their benefit and for their future children's benefits.
All right. Well, George, thanks very much. I'm told that we also have someone else from the National Parks area. The superintendent at the Boston Harbor Island National Recreation Area is on the line. Giles Parker is on the phone from Boston Harbor, where he is also celebrating the National Parks Centennial today. Hi, Giles.
Hey, how are you doing? Happy birthday to the 413 National Parks, and hello to George.
Okay, well, George just left us, but he's now off the line. But I want to know what you're doing to celebrate the birthday today, Giles.
We're starting off a three-day celebration for the Park Service downtown, right at Long Wharf North, where boats typically depart for the Boston Harbor Islands. We had free ferry service all day. We have a stage right now with concert going on and 8 themed tents. But then all the fun continues tomorrow and Saturday at the Charlestown Navy Yard, where Rosie the Riveter, the female worker in mm-hmm. World War II, is going to invade the yard with everything from swing dancing and swing lessons to World War II cartoons being played.
So, Giles, we've been talking about some of the challenges facing the parks, especially as you look forward at this centennial. What do you say about the Boston Harbor Islands?
I'd say first off is visibility and raising the profile of the islands themselves. As Celeste mentioned to you, we started to bring in a new model of parks to the Park Service and really focusing on urban areas and different types and different models of parks. It doesn't necessarily mean that's translated into people knowing about the nationally significant resources right in their backyard. And so raising the profile so that people know to come out to the islands or to Bunker Hill or to our partners on the Freedom Trail.
Hmm. All right, I want to make sure that we get some listeners in here. Linda is calling from Medway. Linda, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Happy birthday, National
Parks. Happy birthday, National Parks. What would you like to tell us?
Well, I just returned from a trip. I returned yesterday from Acadia National Park, which is actually also celebrating, I think, its 100th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my first time there, and it's the most beautiful place I've ever been.
Acadia National Park up in Maine.
Up in Maine, Mount Desert Island.
So that's your vote. That's your vote for one of the nicest parks. Have you been to some of the ones around Massachusetts?
Well, I've been to the Harbor Islands. I've been to the National Seashore many, many times.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Linda, thanks very much for your call. We also want to hear from Bill, who is calling from Somerville. He's also calling us about a park. Bill, you're on the air. Bill, are you with us? I think we lost Bill. How about Bill? Are you there?
Yes. Hello. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Yes. Hello.
Okay. Yeah, hi. I'm calling about a rumor I've heard that we have here in Somerville, Mass., the smallest national park in the system. It's Paul Revere Park on Broadway and Main Street. It commemorates the famous midnight ride of Paul Revere.
Anyone familiar with that? Jack is shaking his head no. Celeste?
No, I don't think that's a national park.
I think that may be a rumor, Bill, but I appreciate you definitely hit the right folks to answer that question. nobody knows if that's actually accurate. I want to take some more calls here as we continue to go. Sarah is calling from Lowell. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi,
hello?
Sarah. Can you hear us okay?
Yeah, I can. Can you hear me?
Yeah, your question is?
Excellent. Yeah, hi. I'm actually a Student Conservation Association intern with the National Park Service in Lowell right now. And I was wondering if you guys could talk a little bit about the cultural heritage conservation that goes on through the NPS. I'm doing work with the Collections Conservation Branch, and we work a lot with the objects that come from the historic sites and making sure that those are preserved for everyone. And I was wondering if you guys could maybe talk about the work that the NPS does with regards to objects and cultural heritage.
All right. Celeste, I think you're the one to answer that question.
Sure. And she brings up a really great point in that, people oftentimes when they think about the National Park Service, they end up thinking about Yellowstone and Yosemite and those sorts of natural areas, and yet there are more historical sites within the National Park Service and even cultural sites, historic sites within many of those natural areas. When you think of all of the artifacts and objects, archaeology, historic structures that are associated with National Park System that need to be conserved and preserved, we employ a whole host of curators and archaeologists and historic architects, all different variety of preservationists, museum specialists that conserve and protect all of these wonderful objects and structures within national parks. So that's part of our expertise in conserving the nation's heritage.
You know, I just want to, we've got about a minute left here, and I'd like to touch down with each of you about what do you think visitors should do? It seems that there is an awful lot of affection for these parks.
Right.
So what do visitors do to try to help you address some of these challenges? And I'd like you each to quickly answer that question. Jack, I'm going to start with you.
Well, you know, the National Park Service has been called America's best idea, and our job is to protect it for the next 100 years. Mm-hmm. And there's ways to do that by visiting national parks, letting your congressman know that they need the funding, Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas in Lowell, Bill Keating on the Cape. It's important that Congress knows that these resources are important to this and future generations.
Giles, out there in Boston Harbor, what would you say? What should visitors do to help the parks?
Well, I think it starts with our goal for the next 100 years as well, is to connect and create our next generation of visitors, advocates, and supporters. I mean, we can't do it alone. Today, we had Senator Markey, Congressman Capuano, and Lynch, who have been out to the islands. I think they needed not just hear from the parks themselves, but from visitors and neighbors of the parks about the national significance and the economic impact of these parks as well, which create jobs and drive the tourism industry as well.
Okay, Celeste, last word.
Go to a park near you. There's 15 national parks in Massachusetts. There's external programs that can help your communities. Go to www.nps.gov. You can / and put in your state. It will tell you where all the parks are in your area. And be sure to look it up, because you might be surprised that there's a park right in your backyard that you can help.
All right. Celeste Bernardo, superintendent at the Lowell National Historic Park. Jack Clark, Mass Audubon's director of public policy and a former ranger at the Cape Cod National Seashore. Giles Parker on the phone with us from Boston Harbor, celebrating the National Park Centennial today. Thanks to all of you for being with us.
Thank you.
Come visit.
Stay with us. There is more ahead. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. As Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton campaigns in Reno, Nevada today, Republican Donald Trump touched down in Manchester, New Hampshire.
The real divide in this election is not between left and right, but between everyday working people and a corrupt political establishment that works only for itself.
Joining us to talk about Trump's visit to New Hampshire today is New Hampshire Public Radio reporter Emily Corwin, who was at the event. Welcome, Emily.
Hi there.
So give us a sense of the scene. Who was at this event? What was the tone like, would you say?
You know, it was crowded, not packed. There were a lot of people, a lot of white people, middle age mostly, although I did meet like maybe a 14-year-old who was very excited about Trump. But, you know, there were some women, more men, and the tone, there was a lot of shouting, there was a lot of chanting, a lot of excitement. Even though many of the people I talked to did not support Trump in the primary, the crowd there just seemed pretty ecstatic.
And why is he visiting New Hampshire? This is the second time this month.
New Hampshire is a battleground state. He has a chance here. It went Democratic in the last 3 presidential general elections, but you know the way that the numbers go, I think he's here because he thinks he might be able to win it.
Right. But what we know, at least from the last WBUR poll that was conducted about 3 weeks ago, Hillary Clinton was ahead of Trump in New Hampshire by about 15 points. How does today's appearance sort of factor in with that? Do you think he realizes what the polls are saying about where he stands in New Hampshire?
Well, his talking points have changed a lot, and I think today is a really good indication of that, a really good example of that. It seems like, you know, you can just hear in his speech, if you've been following him, like somebody has sat him down and told him that he needs to change his tune, and he is changing his tune. And, you know, I wondered, listening to his comments about African Americans, about Hispanics, he was talking about them quite a bit today, and listening to people coming in who are saying, you know, well, I voted for Jeb Bush, or I wanted to vote for Jeb Bush in the primary, but now I'm here because Trump is the candidate, and I wonder if that's going to make a difference shoring up those moderate Republicans who were maybe on the fence about him previously.
Right. We certainly knew as well that there was a shift in the Trump campaign. The New York Times, of course, today reporting that Trump was deciding that he wasn't going to go off script quite as much, and his focus was going to be on attacking the integrity of Hillary Clinton. Is that essentially what happened today, would you say?
Oh, for sure. I mean, the first half of his speech was he did not veer for a moment from talking about Hillary Clinton and, you know, casting her as a criminal and just calling into question time and time again her integrity, her honesty, and her connections to Wall Street. He certainly seemed to be doing just that.
It was my understanding that he was suggested to temper his remarks, particularly about immigration. And the last visit to New Hampshire used some really strong words about building a wall and saying that would actually help the opioid crisis, which is very bad in New Hampshire, as it is here in Massachusetts. Was that similar today, or did you notice a toning down?
I think you could really hear in his speech the toning down. He was sort of defending his reputation without, it's as if, you know, he's hoping people will forget the words he's used in the past and take what he's saying now as what he has been intending all along. And it's curious to see, you know, how much people will perceive him as authentic today. He said things, you know, like, I will never apologize for making it my priority to protect American citizens above every other single consideration. We will end illegal immigration and restore the constitutional rule of law. But he was saying that you could tell, or it certainly seems that he was saying that as a way to temper what has, you know, previous statements that have, you know, frankly been racist.
All right. Emily Corwin, a reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio. Thanks very much for being with us, Emily.
Okay. Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The largest LGBTQ newspaper in New England says a recent attack on its newspaper box in Salem is a hate crime. Salem police released a video of 7 people putting explosives into the Rainbow Times newspaper box early Tuesday. Salem Mayor Kim Driscoll is with us to talk about this. Mayor Driscoll, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So where does the investigation stand? Any arrests yet?
Not yet. We're hoping that by releasing this video, we'll be able to get some additional information on who these individuals might be.
What about type of explosives used here?
Not sure as of yet. It did look, certainly looked like something that you wouldn't want to have in proximity to a very busy and hustling, bustling downtown during the day, for
right.
sure.
Right. No one hurt, though.
Thankfully, nobody injured. It was, 1:30 in the morning, so there wasn't a lot of activity on a early Tuesday morning.
It's my understanding this was not the first attack on the Rainbow Times newspaper box in Salem?
Yeah, unfortunately, this box by the Rainbow Times was put out, within relative short period of time in the last 6 months, but has been targeted by vandals in the past, so much so that we moved it into a location that it could be accessible to the surveillance cameras that are on the street. It certainly had not had this level of activity in the past.
Can you describe the area where the box is located?
Yeah, it's right. Anyone who's familiar with Salem, it's right downtown, what we would call Townhouse Square, the entry point to the Essex Street Pedestrian Mall, directly across from the Bewitched statue that exists, a very popular point of busy pedestrian crossing area during the day.
So if you move the box to be near surveillance cameras, and this still happens in a very busy area, are there any other steps that you're thinking about next?
I mean, Salem as a community is very progressive, very diverse. We really, consider ourselves to be a place that is very LGBT-friendly, and I think our community is really rallying around Nicole and Grizel, the publishers of the Rainbow Times, who live in Salem. And I think going forward, it's that type of vigilance and community response. There's been a tremendous amount of support Everyone standing tall with the two of them and with Rainbow Times. And that's really what we need to do to defeat these acts. We'll know more about the individuals and what the target might be or what the motivation might be. But I think as a community, we stand tall and stand strong, and that's the message we want to send, that we're not going to let this type of activity define us or defeat us.
Yeah. Now, some folks say it's a hate crime. What are your thoughts?
Well, it certainly appears to be. The fact that it was targeted before, and then this, you know, I mean, this, we're lucky nobody was injured. This was not, it's not just an act of violence when you're targeting an LGBT group, and we're treating it very seriously.
Mm. You know, the publisher of the Rainbow Times released a statement saying, quote, in the current political climate, when a presidential candidate can use inflammatory words and actions and even encourage violence toward people of other backgrounds, we must prepare ourselves for the inevitable consequences of such violence. Rhetoric, meaning that as society essentially has gotten less civil, maybe we should expect that there will be less civil forms of behavior. What are your thoughts about that? Is there any sort of connection, do you think, between sort of a hostile political environment and hostile acts in public?
I definitely think the level of civility that, you know, you see at times in public office has changed. And I think it's unfortunate. I don't know if it's directly related to the presidential race. But it certainly feels like people feel like they have permission to say things that are hurtful and unkind. And, having manners is a basic principle that I'd like to think we're all aware of, that we should be focusing on more, for sure.
So are you surprised by all of this?
I'm surprised because I don't think of Salem as a community that isn't welcoming and open. And I think it's one of the things that makes us very livable. So the fact that this box was being targeted is surprising. Like I said, we're a community that doesn't stand for this type of behavior. We're all standing very much in support of the Rainbow Times. There's a box there. It's there, you know, it's there today. It'll be there as long as we can have it there. And we have a community of small business owners, people who live here, who are doing all that we can to show the type of support and the type of community we are. We really, based on our history, the witch trials and things that happen here, know how important it is to not stay silent when something like this happens.
All right. Kim Driscoll, mayor of Salem, where police are investigating an explosion at a Rainbow Times news box in the downtown area Tuesday. Mayor Driscoll, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on. Have a great afternoon.
You too. You can also see the video from Tuesday's incident at our website, radioboston.org. And the Rainbow Times has not been the only potential hate crime victim. The Department of Homeland Security is now looking into a cyber attack against Saturday Night Live actress Leslie Jones. Hackers put up what appeared to be explicit photos of Jones and her driver's license and passport photos. All of this on her personal website. Joining us to talk about this and other technology news from this week is the technology writer for the business section of the Boston Globe, Hiawatha Bray. Hi, Hiawatha.
Hello there.
So Jones, Leslie Jones, was battling internet trolls for the past month after her Ghostbusters interview. Does law enforcement have a strong track record in terms of finding out who might be committing these types of crimes?
Well, it's pretty iffy. I mean, it's not really clear how they can track this person down, but it is possible, depending on whether or not they left any traces, like IP addresses from which they might have launched the attack, or any kind of hints that might point in some direction, you know, like maybe even words or terms or something that they might have used in some other context. It's possible, but it's by no means certain that they'll be able to track these people down.
What about the motivation here? I mean, this was clearly an attempt to publicly humiliate. And
I would think so.
Right. And we've seen these before. Sony Pictures hack in 2014, Ashley Madison hack last summer. And you know,
but these are all very different. I think they're very different. You're combining a bunch of different things. The Sony hack is still largely believed to have been undertaken by the government of North Korea or somebody connected with them. Then there are others that are things like this, which just appear to have probably been just some individual or group of individuals who wanted to humiliate somebody.
But I want to talk.
I mean, they're very different.
But I want to talk about targeting here, because and what I was getting to was that there are data from the Verizon data breach investigations report suggesting mm-hmm. in 2016 suggesting that 89% of all of these breaches that it analyzed anyway had some sort of financial or espionage motive. So what I'm wondering here, and that's why I brought up Sony and Ashley Madison, is do you think we're going to see these very targeted, do people not have to worry about widespread hacking as much as they might have to worry about somebody deliberately targeting them or an organization for a personal reason?
Why not worry about both? Because both things are quite possibly going to happen. Of course, most of this is now financial. Back when I first started covering this industry, people who did this were mostly bored teenagers who were trying to make a name for themselves. Nowadays, these are mostly being carried out by international crime rings or by governments that are trying to carry out attacks for intelligence gathering purposes, or even sometimes to undermine possibly a country that they have problems with. That's going to be normal. That has become the new normal. The United States carries out cyber attacks against other countries. And so other countries are going to do it to us. And criminal gangs do it. And this is just part of the world we live in, and it is just going to keep happening.
Mm, but this was personally motivated. I'm talking about the Leslie Jones attack.
Way, yes.
Is this a hate crime? And do you think technology companies or law enforcement, I mean, who's thinking about how to police the internet to deal with now what appears to be another way that hackers can sort of get people online? And another thing that folks have to be worried about. Not that we're all famous actors and actresses here, but
yeah,
still.
Sure. We got to I tiptoe carefully around the term hate crime. For example, there was that whole fuss about what happened to Leslie Jones on Twitter, where people were piling on and saying horribly insulting things about her. I don't think anything there was a hate crime. They didn't do anything illegal. It was just vulgar and disgusting. But when you break into somebody's website, that's a federal crime. And so in this case, I think you could fairly call it a hate crime. And there doesn't seem to be any motivation other than the fact that they just plain hate this particular woman for reasons that are impenetrable to me. I can't think what it is. But if there's one thing we know for a certainty, it is that there's no safe space on the internet. This kind of thing in one form or another is going to happen on the internet, and you can't entirely control it.
I want to switch gears for a minute here. I want to talk about your column today about economist Kenneth Rogoff's new book, The Curse of Cash. And he's talking about a fully cash-free society, plastic only. Your thoughts?
Well, not just plastic only, but also smartphone. You can use your smartphone to pay for things and so on. I think we're going that way. I don't think we're going to go to complete cashlessness. And even Rogoff says that he favors, you know, a few small bills that we would keep around. He makes a very strong case that most of the large denomination money in the world is being used by drug dealers and terrorists anyway. And we could live without it. And in fact, how many of us use large bills? Very few of us. But on the other hand, the loss of cash would also mean the loss of the ability to do private economic transactions that are perfectly legitimate. And I don't want to go that far. I really don't. I would love to dream of something like, say, some of us dream of something like Bitcoin that would allow us to do that. But it turns out Bitcoin isn't anonymous. People have committed crimes and used Bitcoin and thought they could get away with it. And they're all sitting in federal prison right now because Bitcoin can be traced. Nobody's figured out a way to do a digital currency that cannot be traced. And if they did that, then I might be able to go completely cashless and feel good about it. But otherwise, yeah, it kind of creeps me out because I want to be able to buy something and not have the government know I bought it.
But also not be tracked by marketers who are going to then try to sell you everything.
Exactly.
It's not just the government.
Exactly.
It's also businesses who are doing this. And there may be people who want to opt out of this so they're not targeted.
Absolutely. And cash has that one great blessing. It allows you to basically continue to take part in the economy of the country or of the world, while at the same time opting out of this panopticon of total surveillance. That's why a lot of us still would like to see cash floating around. But then I look at my own life and I suddenly realize, except for the occasional cup of coffee, I don't think I spend cash in a week. It's amazing to me how little cash I use. I use Apple Pay, I have Samsung Pay, and I have a piece of plastic. And that's it. And it works.
Watch out, the hackers might be listening. Anyway, earlier this month, Hiawatha, The Globe wrote about places that that don't accept cash, even though that's illegal in Massachusetts, which most people didn't know, apparently. We know the MBTA says it wants to phase out paying with cash. We're going to have electronic tolling only on the Mass Pike starting in October. The other question about all of this cashless economy is, isn't that a hardship for some folks who don't have smartphones and Apple Pay and plastic? Yep. And so what do you do about that?
Well, again, Dr. Rogoff does talk about that in his book, and he says that we may have to, it may be necessary to create special kinds of, for example, prepaid cash cards or cash cards that lower income people can use to translate their income into plastic so that they don't have to carry cash. Another interesting thing is this is something we don't have in the U.S. Tap and go cards for very small purchases are very popular in the rest of the world. They usually have a limit of $20 to $50. It's a plastic card. You buy like a bottle of soda. You walk up, you tap the card, and it's paid. And that's all you do. It's for very small purchases.
And it doesn't track
Well, that's the problem. Like with all these other things we're talking about with cashless, of course it tracks you. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It does track you. But that's true of any of these cashless technologies we currently have. There is no cashless technology currently available to us that makes us invisible. Even Bitcoin can be tracked, and that's the problem, and that privacy aspect of it is a real hassle.
Do you think we'll see the law change in Massachusetts about not accepting cash?
It could. I wouldn't rule it out. I'm not sure you need a law, though. To tell the truth, though, I'm not sure you need a law because you're going to see so few people. I mean, excuse me, I should say so many people moving toward things like all plastic, all smartphone. We may see the return of the tap-to-pay credit card that it's already happening. Something like only 24% of Americans now use mostly cash. It was 36% just 5 years ago. The number of us who use cash is plummeting. So this is just like they're going to meet halfway.
All right. Hiawatha Bray, technology writer for the business section of the Boston Globe. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Hey, it's been fun.
Come on, baby, to a drive-in show. I know just the very place to go.
With summer winding down, we thought we'd end today with a bit of nostalgia. A visit to one of the three drive-in movie theaters in Massachusetts.
Hey, how many in the car?
Three.
27. Thank you. Have a good night.
My name is John Dedarian.
You doing okay over there, Matt?
And I've been working here since 1964.
John Dedarian started in the box office of the Mendon Twin Drive-In Movie Theater during the heyday of the drive-in, when there were thousands of drive-in movie theaters operating throughout the country. Now, there are about 340.
My first movie that I ran or started when I was sophomore in high school was Clarence the Cross-Eyed Lion and Zebra in the Kitchen. It was an MGM double feature. I enjoyed it when I first started because, you know, the movies were kind of nicer films and classic films. But it's been going very good, and now I work for my friends.
Dedarian's friends are Dan and Dave Andelman, hosts of the Phantom Gourmet TV show. Dave says cherished memories of drifting off to sleep while watching movies with his family made owning a drive-in almost a family dream.
I'm Dave Andelman, vice president of Corn Dogs and Salty Snacks. We bought the Mendon Twin Drive-In 3 years ago. It's been around for 62 years. We actually came here when we were little. Our parents used to take us to the drive-in. I remember seeing Dumbo at the drive-in. So it always was just kind of this weird dream to own a drive-in movie theater. And my brother Michael, who's really smart, he went to Georgetown Business School. He called me one day and he said, I know you're going to think this is stupid. I think we should buy the Mendon Twin Drive-In. And I go, bud, I love it. And he went on for 20 more minutes. And then I say, I don't think you heard me. I love it. Let's do it.
Since they bought the drive-in, the Andelmans have added a 5,000-square-foot outdoor patio where they offer beer and wine. They've also worked to make food more of a priority. They also say they want to keep working to attract younger people to the drive-in, many of whom like the bargain that a car full of friends can see two movies for about $25.
Hi, my name is Brandon. I basically work in the snack shack. I help move things along, kind of talk to the customers and see if we can get everybody wherever they need to go as quick as possible. This is like my first experience being here, and like I'm the one that gets to hear everybody else tell me about their experience with the drive-in. So. I mean, a lot of young people too, because, you know, I mean, like if you get to see two movies with a bunch of your friends, packed them all in the car, I mean, it attracts a lot of people too. And then there's the other people who've been coming here since they were kids, so it's like a young and old thing, you know?
Among those for whom the drive-in is a summer tradition is Adele Miller from Milford.
Yes, so we have pillows and sleeping bags and
I only brought a blanket.
Blankets, pajamas.
She's come here every year for almost 20 years. As she was setting up camp near her car to watch the shows with her young children, she told us the drive-in really hasn't changed much over the years.
Sometimes they stay awake for both movies. Sometimes I stay awake for both movies. And they are used to being carried in at, you know, 1 in the morning. So, yeah, we take our drive-in experience seriously.
When it's over and we're heading back, we'll stop in for just a little snack.
Those are voices from the Mendon Twin Drive-In Movie Theater, one of three drive-in movie theaters operating in Massachusetts today. Our story was produced by Radio Boston's Adam Asher.
Six hot dogs ought to be just right after such a
warm. And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Imogene Weinstein, Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzak. We had help today from Cassandra Sunt. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston. Do 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 do